I think my father was a great man. And there was one night we were taking supper together. We weren't even talking about the family at the time. But he put down his silverware and he looked me flat in the face and he said, "You know, I'm a great man too." And this comes out of a feeling that my grandmother had eyes only for my grandfather. Well, this is what makes this family maybe a little bit unique. Well, my name is Conrad Feininger. I am the middle son of Tilox Feininger, who was the youngest son of Lionel Feininger. I'm an actor. I had a 35-year career in Washington, D.C., acting on stage and also recording audiobooks for the Library of Congress.
My name is Anja Guttenberger, and this is my podcast, Bauhaus Faces. Welcome to my new podcast, Bauhaus Faces. I'm Anja and I'm your host. For the past 15 years, I have worked with the leading Bauhaus institutions as a curator, author, and editor. I wrote my PhD thesis some 12 years ago about photographic self-portraits that were created at the Bauhaus in Weimar, Dessau, and Berlin. And yes, my mother tongue is not English. I'm German. But I really want to reach as many like-minded Bauhaus fans as I am, so I will try this in English. In my podcast Bauhaus Faces, you will get to know known and unknown Bauhaus students and masters. And for my very first episode, I chose a Bauhausler very close to my heart, and his name is Tilox Feininger. And maybe the name Feininger rings a different bell with you. Maybe you're thinking of Lionel Feininger, that was his father, a very well-known painter, or of Andreas Feininger, who was his older brother and a well-known photographer in the US. But for me, it's always been Tilox Feininger and his very special artwork and his very special life too. And in case you don't know anything about Tilox Feininger, don't worry, you will after this episode. So let's get started. Tilox Feininger was born as Theodor Lucas Feininger on 11th of June 1910 in Berlin, Germany. He got his name from his godfather, the painter, the American painter, Theodore Spicer Simpson. His father was the well-known painter Lionel Feininger, and his mother was Julia Feininger, who was also a painter before she met Lionel. As it was the time, the 1920s, she directed her attention to being a supporter for her husband and her husband's artwork. Tilox had two older brothers, Andreas, whom you might know, he became a well-known photographer in the US, and Lawrence. And he also had two older half-sisters, Lore and Marianne, who both were photographers too. They were products of Lionel Feininger's first marriage. This is Conrad Feininger.
They were perfectly content to be apart. Lawrence lived in Italy. We saw him maybe one or two days a year, if that. And he would usually come when he needed more money. And Andreas and Lux, you know, Andreas in New York, Lux Cambridge, 210 miles. They saw each other maybe five times in 30 years. They would say there was no war, no struggle, no unhappiness. The family has always been content to be together and not together. My favorite little story from my father about his father is that he loved having his family around him on the other side of a locked door. Andreas always, as the eldest, had the attention and the support of Julia. He had a car in Dessau. And my father said he had to borrow my grandmother's glasses just to go to the movies. It's funny, the stuff that lives on. But Andreas was a very private person. Vissa was more friendly and more open. But the gossip that I heard was that Visse was a student at the Bauhaus, and when Lux went to Paris, Julia foisted Andreas on him because he needed something to do. And so Andreas is with Lux and spoke no French and didn't know how to cook and did nothing around the house. And Visse came to Paris actually to visit Lux and left with Andreas. So, yeesh. You know, and the past gets erased. I also didn't understand or know that my father had half-sisters. I went around saying there hasn't been a female Feininger for 100 years because Lionel begat Lux and Lux begat us, and Andreas had one son, a boy, of course, but they were frozen out. And she and her sister were around. You know, there's a picture of Julia's father with all five of the little children on a park outing, which for that period, for him to embrace the children of an adulterous first relationship. And she was in Dessau taking pictures of Lux as a young man. So they weren't eliminated from the family, but I think Julia tried to control the relationship. We found by accident while settling my father's affairs that he had his father's library. And we found 15, maybe 20 little tiny watercolors, ghosties, that Lionel, it turns out, made for the daughters and would send to Europe. They were behind the Iron Curtain, and also money. But it was secret. It was not overt. And so I think Julia tried to control those things.
From the very beginning onwards, Julia tried to make sure that art was the family business. She herself came from an artist family, and her husband, Lionel Feininger, too. The parents were musicians, so art was being taken really seriously in this family. Art was a big part of their lives. It was just a normality that everyone would paint or take photos or make music, and that great paintings would be around the houses. And it's just as normal today that those great paintings by Lionel Feininger, Tilux Feininger, and the photographs of Andreas and Tilux Feininger, and also by Lionel Feininger, are in museums around the world and are part of the big collections of modern art today. In my interview with Tilux in 2007, he also talked about the importance of art for him, that it was not just a pleasure.
I wouldn't call it just for pleasure. I mean, it's not necessary to paint. You can live from bread and water quite happily. Photography is no different. It just uses a camera instead of a palette and brushes. It's an art like any other. It's like also like poetry. That's also not necessary. That's also not always pleasure. You know, there's a lot of hard work in that.
So art was always part of the Feininger brothers' lives. Their father, Lionel, was the first master who was appointed as that at the Bauhaus by the founder and first director of the Bauhaus, Walter Gropius. And so the whole family, the whole Feininger family, moved to Weimar to stay there. It was not a big pleasure, as Tilux remembered in his memoir, which is only published in German at the moment, under the title Zwei Welten, Two Worlds. He still remembered really well how bourgeois the whole population of Weimar was, and that they were pretty anti-Bauhaus, and that it was but a step from the art to the artist and to the offspring of the artist, which was him and his brothers. So he wasn't really happy there. And when the Bauhaus moved to Dessau in 1925, the whole Lionel Feininger family went to Dessau as well. Although Lionel made a deal with Gropius, so to speak, he didn't want to teach. He found it tedious to teach. So he would happily come to Dessau and live in one of the master's houses, but he wouldn't want to teach at the Bauhaus. And Gropius agreed, surprisingly. He had his poster child to attract new students to the Bauhaus, but the students who came there exclusively to be taught by Lionel Feininger, well, you know, they came in vain, obviously. In Dessau, Lux was around 14, 15, 16 years old, and he became acquainted with photography. He started doing it first with self-portraits and a mirror when he was 15, 16 years old. Most of them were masquerades, so he would dress up as Charlie Chaplin, his big idol, or Lon Chaney, who was also an actor, but as he told me, it was more the horror of his appearance because he played mostly in horror movies like The Phantom of the Opera, and he was pretty scared by him. But nevertheless, he was pretty impressed, so he dressed up as him, and he also took photos of himself with his face being covered by wooden masks that he had carved himself, still on Weimar. And all of these self-portraits he took in his own boudoir, in his boy's room in the master's house in Dessau. And his big brother, Andreas, he was the first woman at the Bauhaus to set up a dark room in the master's house bathroom, and he allowed his younger brother, Tilax, to develop his photo prints there as well. So this was his first dabbling in photography. And when he was 16 and a half, he also became a student of the Bauhaus, the youngest student ever to be accepted at the Bauhaus. And by the way, the only offspring of a Bauhaus master to become a student at the Bauhaus. Tilax became part of the stage class under the leadership of Oskar Schlemmer at the Bauhaus. And he also became part of the Bauhaus band playing the banjo. Once Theodor is an official part of the Bauhaus, his image motif changes drastically in his photography, shifting from the very quiet and intimate self-portraits with masks to the vibrating, loud and vivacious every day at the Bauhaus. And Theodor Lucas becomes Tilax, the light itself, the camera lens, the documentarist from the student's perspective. At least that's what I thought. In my mind, this would have made perfect sense, as Lux in Latin means light, and photography itself literally meaning writing with light. So photos is a form of the Greek word phos, the name for light. But man, was I wrong. Conrad Lux's son could not confirm my theory at all. He said Lux was Theodor Lucas's family nickname and that he used it when he wanted to make it as a painter on his own without any affiliations to his famous father, the painter Lionel Feininger. Well, my art historian interpretational side was a little shattered by this clarification. But hey, I really only want to tell you all the truth and not only my assumptions. That's why I asked. So these photos, although only few people know the name of the author today, they do decorate the covers of countless publications about the Bauhaus. Later in the 1980s, Lux would say about his Bauhaus photos, and I quote, "I wanted life, action, faces and figures. The Bauhaus architecture enthralled me. It was the stage on which the daily drama of existence was enacted." End quote. Tilax's photographs are characterized by steep angles and extreme close-ups, and he captured vivid moments like the band playing and swinging to the music, Bauhaus students jumping high in a football match, and the Bauhaus building in the back seems to be overjumped by them, grimacing and gesticulating friends, members of the Bauhaus stage in their abstract costumes, posing staggered for the camera, or a wild horde of students hysterically laughing and running towards the photographer. Being a Bauhaus student became fashionable, especially through these photos by Tilax Feininger and by similar photos of other students that were regularly published in the Bauhaus's own newspaper. And they were most certainly a critique towards the far too earnest Bauhaus masters that needed, and I quote Lux again, taking down. Now, the rebellion of the youth against the old establishment is an ever-repeating story, even at the Bauhaus, obviously. And the style in which Lux Feininger shot his Bauhaus photos is called the New Vision. Now, let me give you a few facts about the New Vision. New Vision, or Neues Sehen in German, was a photographic movement in the 1920s. It made the camera lens appear to be a second eye for looking at the world. Unexpected clippings, cut-up jerks, close-ups, or for example facial parts, and extremely high or low camera angles were the most frequently used tools to express a new sense of seeing things and persons. And those are all things that you can find in Tilak's Finding Us photography that he took at the Bauhaus. The photographs of the new vision, they quickly became part of the many illustrated magazines that circulated Germany and also of the flourishing advertisement industry at the time. From there, it was but a small step into the art galleries and museums. The most famous artists of this movement are the Russian photographer Alexander Rodchenko and several Bauhaus students and masters such as Tilak Feininger and Laszlo Moholy-Nagy. Lux Feininger very quickly became very big in the new vision business and was represented by one of the biggest German photo agencies of that time, the Defurt. A former Bauhaus student, Otto Umber, who was practicing as a photographer under the name of Umbo, he had suggested him to the Defurt. And well, from 1928 to 31, he was represented by them. Yeah, he sold his photographs to illustrated newspapers like Die Woche, The Week, Frankfurter Zeitung, Frankfurt Newspaper, and Kölnische Illustrierte, Cologne Illustrated. This is again Lux Feininger himself.
I put all my spare efforts into photography and I was getting along very well. I could have made a living that way at age of 19. It never went away. I mean, I still photograph, but it isn't the same.
Well, he never truly put to the test if he could have made a living out of that or not, because he was pretty well provided for at home. So as quickly as the fees came in, he spent it. In 1929, some of his work was exhibited at the FIFO, the International Film and Photo Exhibition by the German Werkbund. In 1931, some of Tilak's photographs were even acquired by the Museum of Modern Art, the MoMA in New York. He was an up-and-coming New Vision photographer. However, Tilak didn't want to be recognized as a Bauhaus photographer at all. He'd rather be recognized as a painter, as a serious painter, not being compared with his father. His rediscovery as a photographer was really an accident, I have to say, when a gallerist from New York, Eugene Joseph Prokappis of the Prokappis Gallery, which was one of the best photo galleries of that time in the US, visited him actually to take a look at his paintings. This is Conrad remembering the visit.
I think that my father had put the Bauhaus away for a long time. His coming back as a famous photographer of the Bauhaus happened by accident, and it kind of pissed him off because, I mean, in his essay for the first big exhibit of his photos in the early 70s, he said that photography for him ended in 1950s except for family photography. And it was a fluke that these pictures were rediscovered. A gallery owner from New York came to see his paintings, and he had been filing photos and filing papers as he always did, and they were lying around, and this guy saw them. And Prokappis, his name was. And that put him back on the map and put the Bauhaus back on the map. He didn't see himself that way anymore, and wanted very badly to be seen as a painter. But I think at the same time, he has to recognize that he had a relatively unique talent. You know, we go about with our iPhones and snap 50 pictures of things that interest us, and then we keep maybe one or two, and well, nobody thinks anything about it. He would go with 12 glass plate negatives for the whole day and come back with these pictures that he did, you know, the sport over the Bauhaus. That's an amazing photograph, especially if you don't have a motor drive to go.
Before we explore Lux's actual passion, painting a little bit more, I have to tell you the circumstances first. Lux Feininger stayed at the Bauhaus as a postgraduate student until 1932. And 1932 was also the year that life turned sour in Germany for visionary artists, for Jews, for left-wing politicals, and for other thinking people, really. It was the year that in Dessau the Nazis came into power, and was shortly before the Nazi party, the NSDAP, and with it Adolf Hitler came into real power, which was in January 1933, so 1 year later. Lux was one of the few people who very early on felt the threat of the Nazis and that it was real, and that he needed to leave his home. It still bothers his son Conrad today, though, that his grandfather Lionel Feininger did not foresee what could happen to him as an abstract painter in Nazi Germany, and being married to a Jewish woman, and being one of the painters on display in the so-called degenerate art exhibition in Munich then in 1937, so a few years later. Conrad calls his grandfather careless about the situation and does not understand why he could not foresee that he was not as untouchable as he thought as an American. And nevertheless, he was in the US in 1936 for a teaching profession. He returned to Germany that year, and it took some more time to leave the country. Lux, however, felt the need to leave Germany in 1932. First of all, he went to stay in Paris in his godfather's apartment. He began painting furiously and took himself serious as a painter and not so much as a photographer anymore. In 1935, he returned to Germany because of obligations, probably because his good friend Clemens Röseler from the Bauhaus, that he was really great friends with, had died from tuberculosis, and he had to sort some things out. He came back, but then very quickly left for America with the money that he had earned from an exhibition. But let's hear Lux himself about this.
Yes, and I think my mother began to worry what was going to her paycheck. My friend Clemens had already a one-year appointment at the Stadttheater in Stralsund, and I visited him there in 1929. He was quite successful, but he said, "It's not the life for me. I'm not going to go on with it." Mm. He had been in the stage class too. Mm-hmm. So I spent a week there, and what I saw of theater life was all very jolly, but didn't appeal to me either. Mm-hmm. It was just the beginning of the depression, you know. I decided, when asked, to declare that I was not going to try to get work as a stage designer. We left it at that. New substitute was introduced. I began to paint, and a year later I had already sold something in Berlin at the Reckendorf House, the Kunstclub also. There was an annual juried exhibition of young painters. I then got invited by the Kunstverein in Erfurt to make a one-man show. That was a considerable success. I went to Paris with some of the money that I earned there. And in Paris, I greatly enjoyed myself. And I formed the plan to move to Paris if I could. I went back to Germany, of course, because I had obligations. And so I was 21 by that time. I raised with my parents and my godfather, who had a studio in Paris, that I would come back there in 1932. He had suffered losses due to the depression and could not afford to keep two places going. He had a house in the country in which he and his wife lived, but he wanted to keep hold of his studio in Paris. And I offered to do that for him. I would pay the rent, but it would be his studio. I did that for a year, and then I found out that I could do better elsewhere in Paris. This was an old Rebetten house.
Oh my gosh.
Century, maybe a 17th century house. With his consent, I liberated myself and I got a much nicer place in the suburbs at the Porte de Saint-Cloud. The rent was a little higher, but there was no real estate tax, and that made it cheaper. And then I painted furiously for a year and a half, and then I got a one-man show in Berlin in 1935. The rent was also very successful, and with that money, I equipped myself to come here. In those years, this is long before your time.
Yeah.
The year 1932 had three general elections in Germany, and each time the Nazis and the communists grew. At each time, the central to conservative parties went down. The end could be foreseen. I foresaw it. I said, I'm getting out. And I did. But my parents did not.
But what started with the immigration to the U.S. by Tilax and later Lionel and Julia Feininger became a real art detective tale. This is Conrad telling you about it.
He saw earlier than others the what he called the brown wave. But I think it was clear to him before anyone else that they were going to have to leave. So when Andreas married a Swedish woman, Vissa, he went first to Sweden and then decided to emigrate to the U.S. The last to go were Lionel and Julia. They didn't leave Dessau. They were in the master house 2 years after the Bauhaus left Dessau, which didn't really matter since he wasn't the teacher anymore anyway. But he only left when they threatened to search the house, which then triggered the Quedlinburg Klump person who had friends in the National Socialist movement to remove all the stuff and keep it safe, which was a big service for the family. But it was smuggled out of Dessau in a dry cleaning. He was heroic until he refused to give it back. It was only my grandmother's death that caused the lawyers to go after it. And then it becomes like a detective tale. You know, when Klump says no, and then when we beat Klump, then the government says no, they're national art treasures, and they can't leave. And then the law firm manages to sue the GDR. They sent a fax to some little office somewhere, and it was actually received, and that got it into court, and then they won. But, you know, the last exhibit at the Quedlinburg Museum featured aspects of what's left to the Klumps. They did not lose in all of this. They have some of the finest works on paper. Still, they're part of the settlement and leave me with the suspicion that maybe somebody knows something about some negatives or something, or they're equally lost in the house. Just, it was a complete shock out of the blue in 2011 when the then director asks to meet, and we are in New York for the Lionel retrospective, and oh my God. Almost never seen the light of day. Been stuffed in a drawer for 50 to 75 years. It's amazing. But how you don't know that you have this.
And so until today, there are hardly any glass negatives of the photos that Tilux Feininger took at the Bauhaus. And there are only prints from which he doesn't really know how they've gotten into the different archives, because there are prints at the Bauhaus Archive in Berlin, at the archive of the Bauhaus Dessau Foundation, but also at museums where he had no idea how they've gotten there. But most probably he suspected over friends that he had given the photo prints to because they were in the photo or just as a present. He was really generous about his photos and was happy to distribute them among his friends. Once Tilux Feininger lived in Paris and started painting and concentrating on being a painter, the motifs, they changed again from the vivid Bauhaus life, from the photographs, to paintings of boats and trains and railway equipment. And when he went to the US, his style changed again. And this kind of style his son Conrad describes as magical realism. Magical realism was a movement in literature and painting that shows a realistic view of the world while also adding magical elements and often blurring the lines between fantasy and reality. Let's listen to Conrad talking about his father's paintings.
At the beginning, yeah, that also was a time of painting old railroad equipment. He was fascinated by the sea. A lot of people are now identifying his model yachting with his father as some of the genesis for this. But Lux loved to study. You know, he could tell you the Latin name of any plant you ever saw. He spoke four languages. So when he developed this interest in the sea, his pictures were frighteningly accurate, you know, the number of sails on a bark or a man of war or whatever. But why actually, I mean, he crossed the ocean in a ship, but he had a little sailboat when we were children, and he sailed a little boat in Dape too. But the fascination with the already dead industry of sailing ships for moving cargo or for fighting wars, it just piqued his imagination. His favorite writer was Joseph Conrad. That's why I have my name. No, it was almost exclusively marine, either pictures of sailors or of sailing boats. I know of almost of nothing else. Some of his little life sketches, you know, he would do like Lionel. He'd go out on the street and draw of Parisian people and Parisian pets. I love his pictures of dogs from the street. Very humorous. But in his New York period, one could identify him as a magic realist. Lifelike and yet more so. Maybe 400? I have 34, and my brothers have an equal number, and that was what was left of the studio. And then there are the sales and the museum pieces and so on around the world. He was relatively prolific, maybe not so much as Lionel. I don't understand how they did what they did. You know, you see some of these yacht models. They are fantastically intricate, full of little tiny hardware and so on, all hand-built by themselves. Okay, that takes time. 2,500 watercolors, that takes time. 500 paintings, that takes time. Then comes the photography. You know, each print is at least 9 minutes. So when did you sleep? And he has said of his father's studio that he loved the smell of the paint, the varnish, and the tobacco. I have the same memories, but, you know, to go to the studio was a big honor. The door was always closed. The sign on the door was always directed at the cats, but it meant the people too. This was partly his choice. He hid his light under a bushel. You know, when he made exhibits, it was with little old ladies who had hobby galleries in small towns like Concord, and he taught until he was 65 in 1975 and felt he was a great man and wanted to be known as a great man, but did not do anything about it. He never had a gallery represent him. He didn't really push himself forward at all. So it's left now to me to do it.
There were indeed just a few bigger exhibitions that Lux was part of in the US, such as the Revolution and Tradition in Modern American Art exhibition in the Brooklyn Museum in New York in 1950, or the exhibition Four Painters in the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Boston in 1955. or two retrospectives of Telux Feininger, one at the Busch Reisinger Museum in Cambridge in 1962 and one at Trinity College at the Austin Arts Center in Hartford in 1967. Conrad seems to be right. Otherwise, there are not many exhibitions. And if it was more the old auntie back room exhibitions that he talked about in our interview. Yeah, it leaves us with the question, really, where can we find Lux's paintings today? Where can we see them in museums? And I've picked out three examples that you can also find online. And those are at the Harvard Art Museums, at the Museum of Modern Art in New York, and at the Kunstmuseum Moritzburg in Halle in Germany. Those are three locations where you can still find paintings by Lux Feininger, apart from the paintings that are, of course, left in his family with his three sons, Charles, Conrad, and Lucas. But apart from his paintings, there's, of course, the private story of Lux Feininger in the US that is pretty moving, I would say. After his mother's death, Conrad and his father, Lux, became friends and got to know each other closer than before. And topics that were once forbidden in the house because Conrad's mother was pretty jealous and didn't like the war at all, they could now talk about Lux's first wife and also about his time at the army. And that's quite an important part in Lux's life. When the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor on 7th of December 1941, Lux went into shock mode. The American now joined World War II and he was soon drafted for the army. How dramatic this break must have been for the young artist shows his division of his life afterwards as an artist into before Pearl Harbor and after Pearl Harbor. Until 2nd of December 1945, Lux served as T Sergeant with the Military Intelligence Division. In his curriculum for the US Army in 1942, he wrote, quote, "I wish to emphasize that I'm a good American, actually the best kind, the kind that came here because he wanted to." End quote. In the same CV, he wrote about his pictures, quote, "I paint ships and railroads because they seem beautiful to me, because they make good pictures and because I have dreamt about them. Why I have the dreams, I am unable to say, but in my eyes, it makes a good reason for painting as I do. I'm not committed to excluding other subjects in any future career I may be fortunate enough to have after the war." End quote. And while on the 3-day leave from the army in the beginning of April 1944, Lux met Jean Sinan, his first wife. They married only half a year later. Let's listen to Conrad about all of this.
He was inducted right after the beginning of the war. By April of 42, he was in the army, and he was there until after the atomic bomb, again working on Japanese military secrets and scheduled to be part of the invasion force. But because he was married, he was let go a little earlier than some other people. And I always thought his war work was questioning German prisoners of war, because of his language abilities and so on. But he was actually drawing pictures of Japanese military equipment. And we found this out because we were emptying out the house, and in the bottom of some kindling for the fireplace, we find these. So he couldn't bear to throw out, but he promised he had. To some extent, and it wasn't the only subject by any means, but Jean came back out of the closet, the first wife, and he could talk about her without causing upsetment or shame. And so there were lots of stories about that and about their early life together. Well, they were very happy. It was her second marriage. She was a singer. The photos show a very happy relationship with my grandparents, which was interesting to me because my memory and the descriptions of Julia and my mother are not happy. And then there was a lot about when she got sick. You know, it was 1949. They had, say, 4 really good years together once the war was over. I mean, she visited him in his assignments in Maryland But they didn't really live together until the war ended in 45, and he was released. And when she got sick, it was this old school. Her doctor made Lux promise to not tell her how she was and to lie and say, oh, you're getting better, you're getting better, you're getting better. He lived on the edge of Greenwich Village, within 10 blocks of Vissa and Andreas and Lionel and Julia. And during this sickening and slowly dying, nobody came to visit. He had no help, no support, not once. And he was still deeply angry about that. And I don't blame him. But on the other hand, if you're supposed to be lying to the person and telling her she's getting better, that would have been hard to come and do. Oh, my God. Well, I think it caused a breakdown. And if nothing else, his health descended enough so that he could capture TB and spend 10 weeks in a hospital where his doctor only allowed him 10 cigarettes a day. He was very upset about that. It's unbelievable. And when he got better from that, he decided he would become a teacher. And he taught at a girls' college, Sarah Lawrence, for a couple of years, but he did not get tenure. So he was looking for work. And friends of his parents, who became friends of his, had contacts at Harvard and Cambridge. And so he went, and once he got a job there, he moved to Cambridge. I think he was happy to leave New York. It was full then of very sad memories. He had a very happy first marriage, from all descriptions. So happy that it was kept a secret from us children, because my mother couldn't stand him talking about his first wife all the time. Found out when I was 20, I saw a picture of her and asked, who is that first wife? Why didn't you tell me? It's none of your business. So I, of course, got him into trouble by running downstairs to ask my mother all about this. Well, she had made him promise to erase her from his life. And it wasn't an unfair request. They had a happy relationship. She gave him a chance at a second life. She was 16 years younger, and we came out of that. He was in his 40s and 50s when we were all born, the three of us. But she was very jealous. My father used to say, don't ever tell me anything you don't want your mother to hear, because I keep no secrets from her. Once she died, I find this photo, this photo, this photo. You know, it goes even deeper than that. She was violently anti-war, my mother. And she made him throw out his war work. And two of the paintings that are about to be shown in Quedlinburg are of his first wife, and he had me smuggle them out of the house because he was afraid she would destroy them after his death. But he, of course, outlived her by 11 years. He taught at Harvard until they didn't give him tenure, and then he went to the Museum of Fine Arts School in Boston. He taught life drawing, basic painting classes, and later, I think, painting as well. I was a child through all of this, and we have lots of sketches he made in the life drawing classes, which was his main work at Harvard. Nude portraiture and so on. But it was somewhat casual. It was never more than 3 days a week, and most of the time was in his studio.
In 1974, Lux traveled back to Germany for the first time after 38 years. He immediately feels at home again and wrote in a letter to a friend, "The trip from Berlin to Halle ended a 38-year absence on my part, not only from Germany, but also from Europe. My own 12 paintings and a box full of negatives of my Bauhaus photographs have disappeared since then. The color impressions of this trip consist of the green of the farmland, of the black, white, red of a magnificent stork in it, as well as of the gray of a rye bread for breakfast, which reminded me of my childhood." 1 year later, in 1975, Lex went into retirement from his profession as a teacher at college. He then occupied himself mostly with sorting out his photographs and paintings and documenting everything. And, well, you know the rest. We talked about the Prakapa's gallery exhibitions in the 1980s and how he became rediscovered as a Bauhaus photographer. In 2006, Lux published his autobiography, Zwei Welten, Mein Künstlerleben zwischen Bauhaus und Amerika, My Life and Paintings, a memoir, which exists in English as a manuscript. On 7th of July, 2011, Lux Feininger dies in Cambridge. The memorial was held at the Harvard Art Museum, Busch Reisinger Museum in Cambridge on 23rd of October. Well, this is when Lux's life ended, but his legacy still lives on in his photos and paintings. And let me tell you this, his paintings were no less than his photos. Just have a look at this catalogue of works that is compiled by Siegfried Schäfer and Cecilia Witteveen. I put the link for you into the show notes. I think Lux would have liked it if you had all looked now at his paintings too, not just at his photographs. And lastly, I want to thank Conrad for his time and all the memories of his father that he shared with me. Thank you so much, Conrad. This podcast episode wouldn't have been what it is now without you and your wonderful voice. Now then, that was the first episode of Bauhaus Faces. I hope you liked it. If so, please hit the 5-star button on Apple Podcasts and tell everyone that you know of that might be interested in the Bauhaus or the Feininger family to listen to it too. You can follow me via Instagram. I'm at Bauhaus Faces there with this podcast. And I've also created a website for you, bauhausfaces.com, where you can soon find all the published episodes too. And please don't forget to subscribe to my podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts, and you will never ever miss an episode. Well, and if you want to sponsor my podcast or single episodes of it, because perhaps there are Bauhaus personalities that are part of your archive or your institution, please let me know, DM me via Instagram. I will be more than happy about some financial support, and you could be mentioned in one of the episodes too. On my next episode, I will talk to textile researcher Judith Raum, who researched for the past 10 years the work of Otti Berger, a widely unknown Bauhaus weaver who was murdered in Auschwitz in 1944. She will help me to get all the facts right about Otti. So, tune in the next time to Bauhaus Faces.